reactor. If you have the money to build one, build it big so
Big,
you can
yeah.
have a better
Sure.
levelized cost of energy,
Yeah.
right? Than the regulatory framework they have to deal with today.
Yeah.
And it seems like nuclear regulation only goes in one direction, which is more complicated.
Yeah.
And that is one of the hardest problems we
Yeah.
have to work with in this industry. Taipower recognizes those plants
Okay.
are assets for the future when
Okay.
people might change their minds.
Okay. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the AfriNuke podcast. On this podcast, we talk about different aspects of nuclear technology using the African voice. And on today's episode, I have an interesting and an amazing guest I've been looking forward to having in the person of Angelica Ong, who has been so front and forward speaking for nuclear technology. He's going to tell us about herself. But before that, I need to say that before getting her, she was kind of introduced to me by my previous guest from Moltex Flex. And today we are going to get an interesting view of nuclear technology and all its fronts from her own angle and point of view. And so, without much ado, Miss Angelica Ong, can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Well, thank you very much for that kind introduction, Jerry. My name is Angelica Ong, and I live in Taipei, Taiwan. You can find me on Twitter at Angelica Ong, at Twitter, and I work as a pro-nuclear activist. Here in Taipei, my organization, Clean Energy Transition Alliance, is working to reverse the nuclear phase out Taiwan underwent this year. And I'm also supported by the Anthropocene Institute to do pro-nuclear activism and reporting all around the world. So, ever since I used to be a reporter, I've always been really interested in energy. And it started off with my reporting on offshore wind, but I really fell in love with nuclear power. And as I've moved from being a reporter to becoming an activist, I realized that the more people got to know nuclear power, the more they realized its benefits and they stopped being afraid of it. So my approach to activism, whether here in Taiwan or anywhere in the world, or online or on my blog, is to just educate. Teach people what makes me excited about nuclear, and they'll be excited too.
Awesome. That's quite interesting. And I really am very much enthused when you said that you moved from advocating about offshore wind and then you pivoted to nuclear. That's kind of an interesting story. And knowing that people are more interested and welcoming of knowing about nuclear even ices the cake the more and makes it taste a bit better, especially for our audience here. So how did you pivot? Like, how was that journey for you to start advocating for nuclear and telling people about the good? Like, coming from a place like Taiwan, that's they are trying to phase off nuclear at this point. So, how is that going on for you? I know we are going to talk a bit about that, but can you give us a kind of a tip of the
Sure.
iceberg?
So, first of all, I used to be a business reporter
Okay.
who didn't know anything about the energy world. So, I started learning about energy with offshore wind because there was a huge government push into
Okay.
the industry from Taiwan. And later on, I found out the reason why they had that huge push was to replace the energy. The electricity on the grid they were going to lose from nuclear. So there was all this money going into the industry. So I did something that I'm still very, very proud of. I started off my own industry newsletter.
Okay.
And for a while, I was actually quite profitable because I just niched down on the Taiwanese offshore wind industry.
Okay.
And I made sure I covered everything there is to know in this very narrow niche.
Cool.
So I did well for myself, but I never stopped being a reporter for other outlets too. So I started writing more about the Taiwanese energy system at large. And that's when I realized that even though offshore wind was making a lot of people a lot of money and it was helping me make my business work, it doesn't work for Taiwan's grid. Hmm. It certainly does not work to replace baseload nuclear energy with offshore wind. It's extremely intermittent, even more so than solar, and building it turned out to be a nightmare of epic proportions for Taiwan.
Awesome. Okay, now we're going to the conversation about how Taiwan started their nuclear journey. Before now, we had a conversation where you highlighted the level of Taiwan's development when it got its first nuclear power plant. And you said that Taiwan was known for Barbie dolls. So can you tell us about, yeah,
sure.
Can you relate the Taiwan's energy and nuclear power plant's journey? Yeah, the broader perspective.
It's really such a sad story when you start from the very beginning.
Yeah.
You have to remember, when everybody thinks of Taiwan now,
yeah,
they think of TSMC.
Perfect.
Chips.
Yeah, yeah.
But we have to take the story all the way back to the 1980s.
Okay.
The 70s. That's when they were planning the first nuclear power plants.
Yeah.
And Taiwan was not a developed country.
Okay.
We already started our manufacturing journey, but we were probably best known around the world at that time for making 80% of the world's Barbie dolls.
Mm.
Other things we made: sneaker shoes, lawn furniture, baseballs. It's not the kind of high value added manufacturing that you would associate with Taiwan later on.
Mm.
However, our leadership had the forethought back then to create a source of clean and cheap and stable energy for Taiwan. So back in the 70s, where Taiwan's GDP per capita is kind of comparable to many countries in Africa right now, it started on its nuclear journey, and we built 6 nuclear reactors.
Interesting.
That gradually came online over the course of, I don't know, 10, 12 years. And that ended up supplying half of our grid with rock solid baseload. And it was the economic foundation that enabled us to further develop our manufacturing.
Awesome.
And, you know, it was back in the day, though, Taiwan was under a non-electoral democratic, it wasn't an elected leader. It was an authoritarian regime.
Got it.
And even though I think the president at the time, President Jiang Jingguo, think he did an excellent job, but he could do what he wanted. He didn't have to worry too much about what people thought. He just said, well, we need a power plant there. We'll just put it there.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, when Taiwan became a democracy in the 90s, part of the backlash was people remembering that nuclear power was imposed on Taiwan without their consent. And unfortunately, because TSMC was also imposed on Taiwan without their consent.
Interesting.
But nobody worried about that. It was, people talk a lot about Morris Chang, but actually the old KMT government did a lot in planning for TSMC and creating the kind of industrial ecosystem that would allow semiconductor manufacturing to thrive, right? So these things don't come without planning.
Sure.
So unfortunately, though, the opposition party that rose up, the Democratic Progressive Party, which is also the party that is in charge now,
yeah,
kind of found their identity by being pro-democracy, but they link in their mind being pro-democracy with being anti-nuclear. Unfortunately.
Antithesis.
So it's been a very unfortunate story ever since, which is they made turning off every last nuclear power plant in Taiwan one of their core mission.
Wow.
And it's always very sad when energy issues become politicized. And unfortunately, they finally succeeded this year in May when the last nuclear power plant in Taiwan was turned off.
Wow.
And ever since then, Taiwan has been in a sort of, I would call it a soft energy crunch.
Wow. Interesting. That's kind of a very good rundown of the journey from how it started up to this time. And it makes me wonder how democracy is both good and on the other side, not too good. Although the part of it not being good might not resonate with some people, and to some people it resonates very, very well. So, and now coming to this point where the last reactor has just been shuttered, it's a very, very sad story, especially for those who are in the nuclear field and the hopefuls for it. Democracy that should have supported it because of its open debate, would there have been any way of rescuing it? I know you are in the course of doing that. Would there have been anything that should have been done maybe before this time that would have stopped that process from happening? Perhaps maybe if the kind of regime that continued held sway up to this time, do you think it would have maybe forestalled the shutting down of the nuclear power plants? Do you think so?
Absolutely. I think there were a lot of mistakes made along the way by the ruling party. And I don't want to discuss it like democracy is good versus not democracy is good.
Okay.
It's a matter of... both ways can work. You know what? I'm a pragmatic person. I just came home from visiting China.
Yeah.
They're doing a fantastic job with nuclear power right now. I'm really, really envious. But I know here in Taiwan, we don't have their system. So we have to work within the system we have. So what are the best practices for a democracy to not just keep the nuclear power plants it has running, but to turn them back on or to build new ones, right? What are the best practices? So in my mind, it starts with something that is actually quite good for all democratic parties, all democratic countries to practice, which is to try and get everybody on your side.
Okay.
And it's not always possible, but I've been really proud of the pro-nuclear movement. I don't say we're always polite. We're definitely not. And we definitely call people out when they're saying nonsense.
Yeah.
But we always try to take the point of view of we're trying to educate the general public.
Okay.
We know there's people on the other side we're never going to reach, but we always try to go for that middle voter is convincible, because in a democracy, your reactors cannot survive if you have one party that is completely anti-nuclear, because eventually they will get in power. It has to be, if you have a democracy, then your energy policy, including nuclear, but especially nuclear, needs to build on public education and a lot of consensus building, and a lot of education, a lot of passion.
Okay.
And is it hard? I won't pretend to you that it's not. It's extremely challenging.
Yeah.
it's so much easier for Russia or China. But I don't want to say it's impossible. I think after many years of going the wrong way, the U.S. is doing it. When France built all their reactors, they were a democracy, even though the leadership was much stronger then. And you can argue that they had a little bit more weight in terms of how they were able to lead their country.
Okay. I'm kind of curious, before we go into the lessons that Africa has to learn and following its ambition for nuclear, is there any particular, because you said now the regime has changed and from authoritarian to democracy and stuff like that, but there should be something that the public or the people in policy that may be pushing for the phase out of nuclear, there should be something they are kind of hinging on or trying to pinpoint as the reason for them to phase out nuclear and maybe replace it with other sources. Is there something like that? Or is it just like a cancel culture? Anything that the authoritarian regime has brought, we have to just pull it down so that democracy will stand. Is there any technical thing, or it's just all about
a lot of it is they've absorbed a lot of the environmental green culture, which teaches you that a giant wind turbine as tall as the Eiffel Tower is green. Solar panels that are made of, you know, polysilicate glass and rare earth metals and all that sort of thing is green, but somehow nuclear power is not green. And it's been a useful electoral topic for them because they can always get more votes by scaring people. But over the years, we have managed to produce a populace in Taiwan that's very, very well versed in how nuclear works and what is baseload and even what is dry storage and why nuclear is cheaper in Taiwan, because we've already built our plants and we can keep running them. So we've educated the public enough that together with the power crunch, it is starting to hurt the ruling party a lot, especially because people don't like it when their bills go up.
I see. That's interesting. So now, trying to create that bridge with Africa and to give us a lesson point of what we should expect. Is there any lesson from, I know you've talked about trying to include the people, you know, Africa, I think is not well suited for the purest kind of democracy in that sense. I would call it a contextualized kind of democracy that is suited for Africa. So is there kind of any experience from what you have gone through
in Taiwan
that we could apply to Africa? Not only on the technical and regulatory side, but on the political and social aspect.
The first thing I want to say is Africa totally deserves nuclear.
Okay.
Because there are a lot of countries in Africa that are already as developed as Taiwan was in the middle of the 70s. Because when you build a nuclear power plant, that is a 100-year relationship you are potentially cementing with another country. And we can leave a little bit of space to talk about that in the end, about the importance of
I mean, like, what you say is quite spot on, because when I remember what is going on in Fennovoima in Finland, of the contract and everything that just happened, coupled with the geopolitics and everything about Russia and the rest of them, we cannot but just take the right step. Otherwise, we don't have that much money to kind of risk in this kind of situation. So looking at Egypt's El Daba project, Kenya and Ghana's hopes, South Africa also coming up very, very strong. What similar or contrasting challenges exist mirroring China's experience, and how do you see global norms evolving around nuclear vis-a-vis IAEA regarding sovereignty and other stuffs that might come around? You know, China is also very much fronting to become an exporter. South Korea already doing it in cooperation with US Westinghouse, because I think it's just a kind of an extension of the US technology, the South Korean one. So now, in the face of all these interests and vendor countries, like, what's the big picture you are seeing, and what's the best position? I think you've given a very good point to consider the kind of vendor and the relationships and the antecedents of those vendor countries. Are there some things that goes beyond the market, geopolitics and stuff like that, that those countries should look into before going forward? And what's maybe IAEA, who stands like a uniting kind of body, can do to foster this kind of effort?
Okay, let's take the IAEA question first, actually.
Okay.
I was just there in Vienna a few months ago, and before that, I had always thought of the IAEA as just the friendly people who got you going on your nuclear journey. But they're very much there to watch over your shoulder and make sure you're not doing anything naughty with your radionuclides. And they're very much there to make sure that everything is accounted for. And their role is to prevent proliferation. That is fair enough, I think, also here, not because we want more nuclear weapons in the world, but because we want more nuclear energy producing reactors in the world. And I really commend Director General Rafael Grossi in elevating the role of the IAEA, or I should say broadening it, broadening the role of the IAEA beyond their inspector role to also playing a very friendly, supporting character role in helping countries go on their nuclear journey. And I think that's so important to make a positive case for nuclear. So the IAEA is always there as a resource, but it's really, really important. Nothing is more important than choosing the right vendor. The good thing is there's not that many to choose from right now. The bad thing is there's no perfect vendor. So I will say that if geopolitics were not a concern, then Rosatom is hands down the best nuclear provider on the planet right now. And that's probably especially true for an African country. Because they are so vertically integrated. So I'm talking about everything from the financing to get you started on your project to the fuel. Because Russia is a uranium producer, they produce the fuel, and they'll even process it for you. So that's kind of an unbeatable deal, and it's how a nuclear newcomer country like Egypt has been able to get started really quickly and successfully. And I think there are other builds are going quite well as well. They have their VVER reactors. I think they just keep improving it and improving it. And they got it from a Gen 2 to a Gen 3 plus reactor. That is very good. And they have it down to a science. The problem is there is a catch, which is that Russia is also by far the most geopolitically sensitive actor to work with in today's world. Now, depending on the country, what is your comfort level? Different countries, depending on their relationship with the U.S., the relationship they would like to have with the U.S., are going to have a different comfort level. China is another, I think, very solid choice. Up and coming, they have not done as much when it comes to exporting as Rosatom, probably because they're building a lot of plants within China. Probably you know better than I do on that account. They have quite a world-beating build out when it comes to how many domestic plants they are just
quite a lot of them. In fact, it's like every other month you see something going on about nuclear in China. Like the coastal regions is like getting flooded already with nuclear build outs. Yeah.
Well, I'm very jealous of you, my friend, when I saw that video of all the amazing access you got on all the cool Chinese nuclear sites. China is another option. And they have successful builds. They have engineers that know what they're doing. And also, they're keen to make those relationships. Like I was saying earlier, a nuclear power plant is not just any project. It is a 100-year relationship. And you know, China's been doing a lot with African countries, with the Belt and Road projects to build infrastructure, to build relationships. So that might be another good option. Now, if you really want to do a non-China, non-Russia option, the Koreans will be the next on my list. And I would say that track record always trumps when it comes to any kind of nuclear project. And their last project, which is Baraka in the United Arab Emirates, was a success.
A very big one.
A very big success. And they got a country that had no previous nuclear experience to an APR 1400 in 10 years. I would say that's quite remarkable. So I would say the price was also, I think, decent. It's hard to say how much they really paid for that plant. But I would say that Korea is a solid third choice. Although I think it is already getting to be a little bit harder unless you're a better off country to make that choice. Because I think once you get away from the fabulous financing deal that the Russians are going to make you and the exceedingly good price the Chinese are going to give you, a nuclear power plant is a lot of money for a developing country. That is something to be keep in mind. Not everybody has that United Arab Emirates money. I would say if you are a developing country, please do not consider, and it hurts me to say this because I do have an American citizenship, and they're the people that invented the technology. I wish they were the best at it. But the Americans and also the French right now, I just don't think it's responsible to recommend them.
Interesting.
Knowing their past record. Now, the French basically have forgotten how to build on time and on budget.
We've
seen their last project to come online, Flamanville, what was it, 15 years or I don't even know how long. And I think Olkiluoto was 18 years before it's built in that. And Hinkley Point C, who knows? We might be waiting for the 2030s before they bring that one online. That's an unacceptable schedule. I want to be around to see my nuclear power.
And
the Americans.
Coupled with the fact that they front load a lot of regulations, like trying to stifle the move to replicate. But I wonder how that's scenario we change with the current advent of small modular reactors, and it's currently being pushed mostly from the US. So maybe they are going to get revived. Who knows?
Well, I think that if Africa wants to play with small modular reactors, then it should ask the small modular reactor vendors to bear a lot of the cost, because your country will probably be either a guinea pig or close to one, because they're still not running anywhere yet, right?
Yeah.
The first one is probably going to be Darlington. They say 2029.
Yeah.
We'll see about that.
Sure.
But I don't even think that's such a great idea to have a tiny boiling water reactor. If you have the money to build one, build it big.
So you
can have a better levelized cost of energy, right?
Sure.
So where are the small modular reactors running right now? There are nowhere. There are absolutely nowhere. So if a SMR vendor do want to come to Africa and build there, say, okay, you invest in us, we'll invest in you. You invest in our regulatory, you help us take some of your risks, and we'll provide you with a project location. We'll provide you with friendly regulators. We'll provide an opportunity for you to put your project into fruition, which is what a lot of them need, the place to put their projects. But you certainly cannot be left holding the bag for unproven designs, unproven companies, let's say, most of them, right? So I would say be careful with small modular reactors, because people often think small is easier than large.
Yeah.
No. Why would it be if it's new technologies nobody's tried before? You're a nuclear engineer. You tell me.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's just scaling down things, but it doesn't remove the basic fundamental principles of the operations. Yeah. But we will see, because your words are correct. There are no prototypes. I mean, like, there are no operating ones yet. So we can only know when we get them built and learn from them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, and I would encourage Africa to create a very sensible regulatory environment.
Okay.
What I mean by that is there's been a lot of what I call regulatory ratcheting in basically all the developing countries. Why do you think the French, they just got stupid and forgot to build a reactor? I don't think that's a full story. You have to look at the regulation back in the 70s when they built their reactors, being a lot lighter and easier to handle than the regulatory framework they have to deal with today.
Yeah.
And it seems like nuclear regulation only goes in one direction, which is more complicated.
Yeah.
And that is one of the hardest problems we have to work with in this industry. Now, say what you will about the Trump administration. At least they are willing to tackle the problem.
I think it's just because the nuclear industry is traditionally risk averse, because they do not want to allow things that happened before to repeat itself. So they tend to tighten things up as time goes on. So, and that reflects on the costs increase and overruns and stuff like that. So that's, I think, the traditional, like, I mean, the nuclear industry is a bit more conservative, if that's the right word. So I'm not saying that to defend the industry, but I think there should be a way of innovating away from this traditional ways of doing things and liberalize the technology. Look at how solar caught up, you know. You don't need to preach solar to any local government chairman or governor or senator or House of Representative or any parliament member in Africa. They know, in fact, people can easily get one and donate to their communities. And this is the kind of stuff we want to happen in the nuclear space. If we can have a situation where we can say, okay, like, this community or this company needs this amount of process heat or electricity, megawatts quantity, okay, this is what kind of nuclear plants that can supply it to you. Okay, go get this from this company. And within a couple of 2 to 3 or 5 years maximum, you have it running. If we can get something like that, I think it will go a long way, because everybody have seen currently in Nigeria, solar plants get built. In fact, when people see it coming on, they get happy, and that happiness expires just within 1 year or two, because you don't see them running again after 2 years. The efficiency gets crippled. Yeah, like in some select universities where they wanted to, like, where they have established some solar farms, like powering those universities with electricity generated from those solar plants. After 1 year, people don't have anything to show for them. Like, they say it's just like maybe a white elephant project. Like, they just did it to deceive them. But I don't blame them, because the technology itself, although it's getting matured, but it has that common itinerant problem of being robust, reliable, and kind of as sturdy as nuclear power plants can be. It can work if we can have something more. You know, we lack a lot. We lack base load in Africa, and specifically Nigeria. When you have a spare part, the spare tire in every vehicle is usually a bit smaller and less robust than the main tires. Okay, so I consider solar like that kind of analog. You know, solar should be like a backup plan for base load. Yeah, so when you don't have the base load and you use solar as your mainstay, it puts a lot of stress on it, and it cannot survive, kind of. So I quite enjoy the conversation, and it goes to say that Taiwan has a lot of lessons for Africa. And I hope that our leaders and those that are looking into nuclear build-out in developing countries and climes can learn some things from Taiwan's case. The democracy aspect, the public involvement, and what you are doing currently. I mean, tell me, what's the... is there any chance of rescue or of salvaging the situation?
I believe so.
Okay.
So the fortunate thing is we still have a functional utility.
Okay.
State-owned utility. So they've preserved the nuclear power plants quite carefully. Mm-hmm. We didn't have the perverse incentives of a lot of the American or European plants, where the sooner you rip them apart, the sooner you can get your decommissioning money.
Mm.
So... Taipower recognizes those plants are assets for the future, where people might change their minds.
Okay.
And we recently had a referendum for whether or not we should restart the Ma'anshan nuclear power plant.
Okay.
Where the yes votes outnumbered the no votes 3-1.
Ooh.
So you think we should have won, right? We should have won.
Interesting. You should win, not you should have.
Yeah,
right? It's a win, but not there should be no should there.
We did win. Okay. But unfortunately, in Taiwan, there is a really high threshold for making a referendum binding. So even though the yes side did win decisively, we could not make the government do it.
Whoa.
But fortunately, I don't think that's a bad thing. I think we have put pressure on the government. We have made it very clear the majority of Taiwanese people, including some of their voters, must have agreed with us, because otherwise you could not have gotten such a high proportion of yes versus no votes. So now the challenge is on them to come up with a good energy policy. Either it brings nuclear back, or at least give us something good without nuclear, right? We cannot keep like walking the wire with the grid reserve levels of 6% and not being able to site new data centers because we don't have enough juice.
Yeah.
Having to turn manufacturers away.
Yeah.
Telling TSMC, be responsible for your electricity. We cannot help you all the time.
Wow.
That's not the way to treat a business that you want to count on to support your economy.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's what you know, I'm trying to do is to, we are in a democracy.
Yeah.
So I would advise that if you are in a democracy, absolutely, technical communication is a skill, it's an art. And you have to make people see the positive. Don't always get so hung up on the negative.
Okay.
Don't let the environmentalists lead you into a trap by always talking about the dangers, the little particles of tritium, and oh, what about the waste 10,000 years from now?
Yeah.
You should address those points, but then you control the focus.
Yeah.
You talk about the vision you see. You talk about the growth you want with stable, cheap, reliable electricity.
Mm.
And you talk about all the ways in which people's lives get better.
Yeah.
And you talk about how long it has been used in advanced countries like the US, Europe. And you talk to them about Taiwan, how the beginning of nuclear energy really began for us in the miracle decades of growth, and it couldn't have happened without cheap, reliable, and electricity that we can control.
Awesome.
So that would be what I say if you're in a democracy. And not all countries in Africa are democracies. And here's what I would say to you. If you are not in a democracy, and you're an African leader or in an elite position or have some say, I would say that even if you don't need to, still communicate with your people anyhow.
Sure.
Because in the absence of communication, misinformation spread like wildfire.
Yeah,
and you might not think you need to deal with it right now, but eventually it might become something that come back to hurt you. So always, I believe that if you, with, no matter what your electoral system is like, if you are doing it for the people, you've got the democratic spirit.
Sure.
And so communicate to your people on that basis.
I mean, like, this is quite spot on, and like the silver bullet, I would like to say, because it goes a lot to say, alluding to the 3-1 vote, I would like to also point that it shows the Taiwanese are actually futuristic in their thinking, because when I look at the European side, Italy that had a referendum, Switzerland also that had a referendum to ban nuclear in the 80s, are kind of rescinding that referendum. I mean, they are going back to the drawing board and resurrecting nuclear again. So, That's really like, that means that Taiwanese are future focused, if that's the right word, you know, and
we are wallet focused.
Sure.
We are wallet focused. We have one of the cheapest power rates in the world, and it just got more and more expensive.
Yeah.
As, first of all, we started focusing a lot on natural gas, and that got super expensive after the war in Ukraine, super volatile.
Hmm.
And then we invested a lot in wind and solar. And Taiwan is so small that we don't have the land for solar, and wind, especially offshore wind, is so expensive.
Yeah.
So people got tired of the intermittency and paying more for lower quality electricity.
Hmm.
People always say, how can electricity be high or low quality? I say, yes, it can. If it's always there for you when you know you need it, then it is high quality.
Sure.
If you have to guess or make it work or work around when it is available, then it is low quality electricity.
Sure. That makes sense. And it's quite an interesting and thought-provoking conversation with you, Angelica. And at this point, I just want to draw from you personally what you hope to see in the next 5 to 10 years as we conclude in this session of the conversation.
Absolutely. First of all, I first got into nuclear not too that many years ago.
Okay.
And just the attitude change all around the world has been an inspiration. But over the next 5 years, what would I like to see? I would like to see a lot more money on the line. Five years is too short in nuclear for me to say I want to see more gigawatts on the grid, because apart from China, again, China the exception, there simply isn't time to get those gigawatts on the grid. But I want to see, like, no more MOUs and letters of understanding, letters of intent or whatever. I want to see big money, real money backing projects. That is the number one thing I would like to see. And I would like to see it in as many countries as possible. We have some good candidates in Europe, but of course, hoping for more than that. And then what I would like to see is, I would love it if the U.S. actually does meaningful regulatory reform. I think it's actually bait and switch for the nuclear industry to say, look at the amazing costs we achieved in the 70s. And not conclude the sentence, which is costs which we will never achieve again because we now have a completely different set of regulatory structures that put our costs in a totally different place. So I would love for the U.S. to take the first step in not in making nuclear less safe. Nobody wants that. But making nuclear less complicated again, which might even make it safer. You don't know, because sometimes more complicated regulations don't always lead to better results. So, you know, fingers crossed on that. And then third of all, a very personal wish, which is I hope that Taiwan turns on its nuclear power plants again, but as a first step to building more. And because I'm greedy, also a fourth wish, which is I hope that one of the Western SMR projects make it, or whatever, because I have seen so many decks, I have sat through so many presentations, and I would just like one of them to cross the finishing line, even if it's small or even if it's not a super adventurous design. I just like to see it happen.
Same here.
I mean, it would be exciting, right? How cool would the molten salt, working on a molten salt project be, right?
It would be awesome. Like, nothing beats it. Like, when you have those juice coming out from those small pockets of domes or boxes in some small landfill pits areas, to be a very big game changer.
All eyes on Abilene, right? Abilene Christian University. If that comes up good, America could be in the game again. You don't know.
But looking forward to that.
Thorium molten salt reactor in Gansu in China. So,
There's one coming up there too as well. So I'm very much also hopeful that the future is brighter than we can ever imagine. And looking forward to it.
Absolutely. I think that if we could, if Taiwan could do it in the 70s, then we can figure out a way to do it today.
Perfect.
It's not like lost alien technology, right? It's not, how did we build the pyramids? It's like this technology was only invented in the 50s and 60s. So it hasn't been that long. Let's figure it out.
Well, that's on a very hopeful note. I would like to say big thank you for showing up on today's episode, and I quite appreciate the time, and I hope to talk to you some other time in the near future.
Well, it's been absolutely delightful. Best of luck.